Good afternoon and welcome back to the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Kevin Barrett, Boy Wonder, on Mondays and Fridays, and Jim Fetcher the middle 3 days of the week ordinarily. But today, I'm Morgan Reynolds, will serve as your guest host. Monday was President's Day, and I have unofficially decreed this to be President's Week. Abraham Lincoln's birthday was February 12, a week ago Tuesday. George Washington's birthday is coming up Friday. And this is a presidential election year. I have a great guest today to discuss the presidents and candidates. We'll discuss them, if not honor them. We've got the great, the mediocre, the abysmal, and the out-and-out traitors. I began this teach-in with Alan Stang of alanstang.com on Tuesday. I had Professor of Economics Tom DiLorenzo, a Lincoln scholar, among other claims to fame, yesterday. And today, I have author Jim Mars. And we'll discuss the current crop of candidates later in the show. And the many marvelous things they promised to do to the American people. As Henry Louis Mencken, the sage of Baltimore, said, democracy is the theory that the common people know what they want and deserve to get it, good and hard. Jim, how are you today? Great to have you on the show.
Hey, Morgan, it's good to be with you as always.
Jim is a, let me give a brief bio. He's a native of Fort Worth. He graduated from the University of North Texas and spent a couple years in Lubbock, I believe, doing graduate work. Was that in journalism also, Jim?
Yes, I have a degree in journalism. That was my major with a minor in English.
And then early on, he covered the police beat, the courts, the military, the local government as a news reporter for major publications in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, right?
That's correct.
And
Go ahead. I graduated from police reporter to general assignments to courts and county government and then military, aviation, aerospace.
And over the years, of course, you've traveled the globe. You've taught a course on JFK assassination at UT Arlington, even UFOs, I understand, if Wikipedia got that right for a change. And
that's correct.
Okay. And
they fought against that. They fought against that for a little while. One of the regents said they shouldn't offer that course, and the reason he gave was because he said no one would attend. And, of course, my comeback was, well, you know, if you don't offer it, certainly nobody can attend. After a few years, though, they relented, and we did offer it, and the first class I had more than 25 people in it.
I would think, yeah, that would attract students. The kind of the out-of-the-mainstream type course would be at least non-boring, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. And, of course, with the recent events around Stephenville, you know, it's the subject's heated up again.
Okay. Let's, of course, Jim is a well-known author. He's got major books like Crossfire, The Plot That Killed Kennedy, Rule by Secrecy, War on Freedom, Inside Job, The Shocking Case for the a 9/11 Conspiracy, and a more recent 9/11 book called The Terror Conspiracy. And What's coming from Jim Mars here in the near future?
Well, you're going to love this one, Morgan. I won't tell you what it's about, but the title is The Rise of the Fourth Reich.
Ah, yes. Yeah, that sounds very fascinating. Good title, at least. Well, I've got the presidential theme working here, and I wanted to start with this Kane, the Thomas Kane Lee Hamilton luncheon, where we were at the same table there. Of course, they were the chair and co-chair of the 9/11 cover-up commission, right? Isn't it standard practice when you have a Washington D.C. investigation that their job is to cover up the truth?
Well, that's certainly the case here because both Kane and Hamilton had been involved in prior cover-ups. the cover-up of the savings and loan scandal and the Bush's involvement in that, and also the Iran-Contra scandal, which they, again, steered away from the Bush's and some of the more prominent people involved.
But during the course of their presentation, in response to a question that was, this was all very controlled, of course, and no questions we had submitted in writing were going to be asked. But one of the
questions—that's what got me—was they said we will entertain questions, but you have to submit them in writing. So we very, you know, meticulously offered our questions, and yet if you, I noticed up at the table when they were sorting the questions, they would just automatically chunk the ones they didn't want to answer, and obviously ours was among the chunks.
I believe, yeah, one of the gendarmes there warned our table. They apparently were overhearing some of our remarks, and what, we were going to be out of order? They thought, they warned us. I can't remember why they thought our table was going to be unruly. But
well, they never offered any explanation. I'm not even sure they overheard us talking. There's nobody around our table. They just, one of those goons came over and said, you know, basically, I'm warning you right now, do not cause any problems. You know, we were all there, dressed nice, had invitations, you know, had paid.
Right.
To come to the thing, you know, it's kind of like, well, why are you selecting us? You know, do you know something we don't know?
Here, let me get to the, I want to start off with Abraham Lincoln, since we've got him as one of our, well, the as you know, the historical and political science establishments, the intellectual community ranks him, Abraham Lincoln, as the greatest president. Of all, and George Washington and FDR also typically in the top three, but Lincoln the greatest, and you and I would rate him the worst for one, if not many, important reasons. But what Thomas Kane said, I believe it was he, it might have been Lee Hamilton, said in response to this question was, well, to hint at some kind of a inside conspiracy in 9/11 is it's on a par with claiming that FDR knew in advance about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor,
which has now been proven to be true.
Right. And as you point out, his other example wasn't exactly a felicitous or well chosen. He said, or the belief that John Wilkes Booth died in the 1900s somewhere and really escaped following the Lincoln assassination.
Yeah, that one, there's a lot of question there, too. I got onto that story years ago working for the newspaper there in Fort Worth when I was approached by a man in Arlington who said he had an original signed photograph or one of those little lithographs, what they call them, of John Wilkes Booth. So he showed it to me, and Booth's name was written there in pencil. I went to a handwriting expert, and they said it did appear to be John Wilkes Booth handwriting. So, you know, I thought the guy might have had something that was kind of historically worthwhile. And then I found out that it was given to him by his grandmother, who said she got it from John Wilkes Booth in the 1880s, long after he was supposed to have been killed in the barn.
Okay,
and that put me on the trail.
We'll return after the break with more fascinating conversation with author Jim Mars. Good afternoon once again, and welcome back to the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Kevin Barrett, Boy Wonder, on Mondays and Fridays, and Jim Fetzer the middle 3 days of the work week. I'm sitting in for Jim Fetzer this afternoon. Morgan Reynolds is my name, and this is President's Week, so I'm talking to one of the nation's experts on presidents. If I look, Jim, at your... This is Jim Mars. You can see his website is jimmars.com. So we're getting the view from Mars, the one here in Texas. And, Jim, if we look at the John Wilkes Booth... entry on Wikipedia, not always a reliable source to be sure, but one thing they point out is that in the mid-90s, there was this effort to exhume the remains from this alleged grave site for John Wilkes Booth in Baltimore. And what makes me suspicious is the courts wouldn't do it. It was and the establishment historians actually put out some kind of a signature campaign to also suppress this. So we conspiracy theorists say, hey, that's one straw in the wind that suggests there's something more to this story than the conventional wisdom is letting us know.
That's very true. In fact, if you go back and really look closely, what you find is that after Booth's escape from Washington after the assassination, word was received that one of his cronies was seen there in Northern Virginia, and they chased him down, and he was in a barn with another fella, and they ordered him to come out, and shots were fired, and of course the famous Sergeant Boston Corbett supposedly fired into the barn and killed Booth, and then they set the barn on fire, and then they dragged out the bodies. And it's true that the accomplice to Booth was fully identified, but the description of the man that they said was Booth really didn't fit Booth's description. He was skinny, had red hair, freckles and stuff. And then so, but then the word had went out that they had killed the assassin, that John Wilkes Booth was dead, which I think was perfectly in tune with the desires of people in Washington, particularly Secretary of War Stanton, who had been mixed up with some smuggling operations and in colluding with some of the Southern sympathizers by passing contraband back and forth. So that, you know, it's fine. The assassin's dead, end of case. Lone Nut Assassin will close the book. When they finally got the body back to Washington, the only person they got to try to identify it was Dr. Mudd, who about a year before had lanced a boil on the neck of John Wilkes Booth. And initially, Mudd said, well, you know, I don't think that's him. But then after he was held in the hands of federal authorities for a while, he finally came around and said, yes, I believe that is Booth. And after that, they supposedly buried him. And the reason they wanted to dig it up is because, according to some fairly reliable information, they were afraid of that very thing, that somebody would dig up Booth. And so his body was surreptitiously taken out of the grave there in Baltimore and was dumped in the Potomac River. So, they again, we see evidence that they were just, you know, getting rid of the proof, getting rid of the real evidence. But what I want to point out to your readers, your listeners, is about Abraham Lincoln, is that, of course, he's hailed as the man who, you know, held the Union together. That's his claim to fame. And yet I would like to read a quote from him a few years before the war between the states. Abraham Lincoln stated, "Any people, anywhere, being inclined and having the power, have the right to rise up and shake off the existing government and to form a new one that suits them better. This is a most valuable, a most sacred right, a right which we hope and believe is to liberate the world. Nor is this right confined to cases in which the whole people of an existing government may choose to exercise it. Any portion of such people that can, may revolutionize and make their own of so much of the territory that they inhabit." And this is the same guy who a few years later, when the South said, well, listen, we're fed up with what you've been doing. We don't like what's happening. We think you're discriminating against the South, so we're going to withdraw. He declared it a rebellion and raised 60,000 troops to march into the South to put down the rebellion. So I guess what I'm telling you is Abraham Lincoln was just another double-speaking politician.
Right. An agent of the socialists, Alan Stang, argues that many of the founders and movers and shakers in the original Republican Party, of course, which in 1856, as I recall, was formed, were refugees of this failed communist revolution of 1848 in Europe, and some of them were appointed Union generals and the like. In other words, Lincoln's big government, big business, big infrastructure was inherent in the original Republican Party.
That's absolutely correct. And whether consciously or unconsciously, he seemed to be following in the footsteps of Alexander Hamilton, who made it very plain that he thought the United States should be run by a wealthy elite, and that there should be a strong central government to keep control over the rabble, the plebeians.
People like Mars and
Randall. People like me and you and most everybody that's listening.
And every, you know, patriotic American. And, you know, the importance of Lincoln ultimately is that he converted what had been the original idea, which was, okay, we're going to have this strong but highly limited central government. We are going to be a constitutional federal republic.
Right.
And yet he made it into a unitary state, you know, global, and all the evils that flow from this empire.
Right. And what a lot of people don't realize, because they're never taught in their history classes, is that Lincoln had almost as much opposition from within the United States as he did from the Southern Confederacy. In fact, he made the remark at one time that the enemies behind him were almost worse than the enemies in front of him.
Well, hey, I want to go back to this assassination thing. Another interesting thing that Wikipedia claimed was that Lincoln was the first president, U.S. president assassinated, and this whole business about the continuation of politics by less tidy means, namely assassination, comes up. And there are the Beatles once again. We're going to talk about violence and presidents and what led us to where we are today. With more conversation, Jim Mars, Morgan Reynolds. I'm sitting in for Jim Fetzer. My name is Morgan Reynolds. And my guest today is author Jim Mars. And on the other side of the break, we were talking about presidential assassination as one aspect of President's Day and thereby President's Week. Tomorrow is George Washington's birthday. And Jim, I want to call your attention to an interesting article by Murray Rothbard, the well-known libertarian economist, historian, and political activist, who had an article back in 1991 called Exhume, Exhume, or Who Put the Arsenic in Rough and Ready's Cherries? And while Wikipedia claims that Abraham Lincoln was the first president to die in office of an assassination, two prior presidents died in office. One was William Harrison in 1841, and then we had Zach Taylor in 1850. And supposedly William Henry Harrison gave too long an inaugural address. He walked out in the rain, caught the flu, and died. And the beneficiary of that was then Vice President John Tyler. Then we have Zachary Taylor, who was eating cherries in milk. This was on July 4 at a picnic, and he was the only one who got this stomach illness and died. And yet we don't, where are the autopsies? I mean, who was the beneficiary of these deaths? The first person you look at is the vice president. And if the president dies when it's not an obvious assassination via bullets or lead, then it's just alleged to be natural causes. There's no, we need autopsies. We need exhumations, don't we?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Of course, back then was a slower and more naive time, and probably most folks didn't really stop to think about, well, who benefits and could this have been a conspiracy? But let's bring it up to modern times. You realize from 1964 to 1988, almost 25 years, every major election was decided by gunfire. 1964, Lyndon Johnson got in on the sympathy vote because of the JFK assassination. The nation was still in shock, and they didn't want any more shock, so they elected JFK's vice president, Lyndon Johnson, who, by the way, was reported on, even in Dallas the week of the Kennedy assassination, that Johnson would be dropped from the Democratic ticket in 1964. So he gets in. Then in 1968, Nixon wins after Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King were assassinated. 1972, Nixon wins again after Wallace was taken out of the running by his shooting. Another lone nut. I'm thinking about forming the Lone Nuts of America Association. There's so many of them. And then in 1976, Carter won after the assassination attempt on Gerald Ford. Actually, there's more than one. And then in 1980, Reagan's elected after an assassination attempt on Carter, which nobody knows anything about. It obviously didn't succeed since he's still alive, but that was in 1979, as they were getting ready to go into the election year, and everybody was accusing Carter of being wishy-washy and not doing anything. So he asked for national TV time, and the pundit said that he was going to announce sweeping changes in the federal government. But he went to Los Angeles on Cinco de Mayo, May the 5th, and for a Hispanic rally, and there they arrested a Hispanic and an Anglo man, and at the time said, well, there's nothing much to this. But then a week later, both of these fellows were charged with attempted assassination of the president. Now get this, the Anglo was Raymond Lee Harvey, and the Hispanic was Oswaldo Ortiz. So Lee Harvey and Oswaldo almost assassinated Carter in 79, and after that he told close associates that he had lost control of the government, and he did not go on TV, did not announce sweeping changes, and Ronald Reagan swept into office. So,
and then, of course, Reagan was the victim of an assassination attempt, who some believe was arranged by the vice president, beneficiary.
Yeah, if it had been successful, we would have had Bush as president 8 years before he got in office.
I recall in the 60s, I believe he was a Black Panther, H. Rapp Brown famously said, violence is as American as apple pie.
Unfortunately, that's probably true.
It's got a lot of truth to it. Now, JFK, we're brought into semi-modern times here now by your remarks, and last Sunday it was in the news, the national news, that hidden JFK documents had been discovered in the district attorney's office there in Dallas.
Yeah, let me tell you about that, because that's this is kind of interesting. There's something funny going on. Supposedly this was a transcript of a conversation between Oswald and Jack Ruby, who of course turned out to be his killer, another lone nut, and it took place on October the 4th. Okay, this ties back to a testimony.
October 4, 1963, right?
That's correct. Okay, now that goes back to the transcript originally was from a Fort Worth attorney named Carol Jarnigan, who I interviewed, okay? And
mm-hmm.
Here's the story. Jarnigan was an attorney, and one of his clients was one of Ruby's girls. He'd gone to the Carousel Club to meet with her and was sitting there when he knew Ruby. And when a young man came in and approached Ruby, and they sat next near him, and he overheard their conversation. And Ruby was saying, what are you doing here? I thought you were in New Orleans. And he said, no, I just got back. He said, I'm going under the name O.H. Lee, which was one of the aliases of Lee Harvey Oswald. So this pretty clearly establishes that this was Oswald, although at the time, Jarnigan did not know who the young man was. But then he overheard him talking about plotting an assassination. So his ears really perked up, and he really started listening. But here's the kicker. What they're saying today is these transcripts in the district attorney's office say they were plotting to kill Kennedy. What Jarnagin told me was they were plotting to kill Governor Connally, and that Ruby was telling Oswald that the boys in Chicago want to open up the state and said Connally's causing them a problem. If we get rid of Connally, we can open up Texas, you know. And Oswald...
Open it up to what?
To organized crime.
Oh, okay.
And see, this is very true, Morgan, because at that time, starting in the 40s and the 50s, both the Chicago mob and the Carlos Mocello mob out of New Orleans had been trying to make inroads into Texas, into gambling, prostitution, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But they hadn't been very successful because they'd been resistance from the local criminals. Okay, the local gamblers and the local pimps, and they wanted to keep their business to themselves. So this was it fits right in with exactly what was going on. So Ruby was telling Oswald, you know, you could shoot him from here, from the club, and I'll leave the back door open, and you can run out. And Oswald, quite correctly, was kind of skeptical, going, well, it doesn't sound like that's a very safe idea. Now, why someone has changed that, and the wording is identical, so it's obvious to me that these documents they're talking about now refer to the Carol Jarnagin thing. Now, the thing to remember about the Carol Jarnagin story is that hearing about this plot to kill Connally, he went to the authorities and filed a report. And that report was filed before the Kennedy assassination. And, of course, afterwards, when Oswald was arrested, Jarnagin told me that he was absolutely certain that the man that Ruby met with was Lee Harvey Oswald.
We're going to learn more about the JFK assassination. I am your guest host, Morgan Reynolds, and I am interviewing Jim Mars, well-known author, certainly a JFK expert. And on the other side of the break, we were talking about this news released by the DA in Dallas and the Dallas Morning News on Sunday about new documents of a Ruby Oswald plot. And, Jim, let's pick up there. I don't think that you completed that thought.
No, well, not completely. So now we have these new documents that were taken out of a safe that apparently had been there for years and years and years in District Attorney Henry Wade's office. He was the district attorney at the time of the assassination. Today, the new district attorney apparently found these. And that story is even troubling because, according to the news reports, they kind of went looking around in these old files because there was a rumor that the pistol that Ruby had used to kill Oswald was buried in those files somewhere, and yet all you got to do is go Google or remember, like I do, and you'd know that Ruby's pistol was auctioned off at a pretty high price to a private collector some years ago. So there's a big question about why they're looking for this stuff and why they found this stuff and why that this transcript, which seems obviously to be a reworking of the Carol Jarnagin transcript where he said he heard Oswald and Ruby plotting to kill Connally, has been altered to show that they were plotting to kill Kennedy. I suspect, and this is sheer speculation, that somewhere back there, either in preparation maybe for a movie deal or a TV deal, that they thought they would strengthen the whole thing and add drama by altering Jarnagin's transcript to read Kennedy instead of Connally, or perhaps at the time or near the shortly after the assassination, somebody decided if they'd alter the transcript and show Ruby and Oswald were plotting to kill Kennedy, it would strengthen the case against Oswald. But of course, by then, the decision had been made that Oswald was going to be the lone nut assassin, so they had to just stick it back in the safe because they couldn't very well come out and have him plotting with Jack Ruby.
Oh, my goodness, that'd be a conspiracy then.
Of course,
yeah.
That'd be a conspiracy.
Yeah.
But let me tell you, the only solid thing in that whole issue, the only thing I'm dead certain about is that Ruby and Oswald were in contact, knew each other prior to the assassination of JFK. And it's not just based on Carol Jarnagin's affidavit that was filed prior to the assassination. It was based on more than a dozen people, including Wally Weston, the MC at Ruby's Club, Esther Mash, who worked for him, Sherry Angel, another employee, Madeline Brown, It was LBJ's mission.
Yeah, it's
man,
well established.
They, you know, all these people said that Oswald was in the club there with Ribby. In fact, one story that's never been told because I didn't get the fellow's name was some years ago I was in the famous backyard on Neely Street where the photographs of Oswald holding his rifle supposedly were taken. And I was shooting a documentary, and this fella came over, and I was afraid he was going to run us off, but he came over because he was just curious, and he said, "You know who used to live here?" And I said, "Yeah, Lee Harvey Oswald." And I said, "Were you living here at the time?" He said, "Yes." And I said, "Did you know Oswald?" And he said, "Well, I didn't really know him, but I knew him by sight. I knew he was my neighbor because we'd waved at each other a few times." And I said, "Well, did you know Jack Ruby?" He said, "Oh, yeah, I was in his club a lot." I said, "Well, did you ever see Oswald in Ruby's club?" He said, "Yeah, I did, because I remember thinking, hey, there's my neighbor." So, I mean, you know, if you do enough digging in Dallas, the idea that, and you know what, I'm sure you remember General Walker, Edwin Walker, who some people thought was involved in the assassination and was, to a certain extent, in that they claim that Oswald fired a shot at him in the spring of 1963. Well, General Walker, I interviewed him in 1964, and this was right after the Warren Commission came out with their report, and he told me then, he said, "Look, Jack Ruby and Lee Harvey Oswald knew each other," and he said, "The Warren Commission is going to have to start all over just based on that fact alone." And this is true. And this is why they're trying to muddy the waters today and act like, "Oh, this is just some phony thing. Oh, somebody's making up a script. Oh, you know," and they're talking about, and that's why they're trying to blow this whole thing off, because if you go back and really study and go back to the Carol Jernigan story, you find that there is plenty of evidence to show that Oswald and Ruby were in collusion prior to the assassination, which means a plot, right?
Right. Yeah, it's amazing now, so many years later, let's see, what is it, 45 years later, that in effect the powers that be or somebody still scared enough to muddy the waters. Now, this takes me to the whole question. It's not just that John F. Kennedy was a president. He was really the leader of a dynasty, as we saw, in that the powers that be assassinated JFK, RFK as well, and then there's MLK. I mean, the 60s was quite an assassination decade. Then we had the whole Marilyn Monroe thing, when she had relations with both of the Kennedy boys.
That gets a little bit interconnected, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? And
you mentioned Kennedy assassination, and then right before that we were talking about the Lincoln assassination. And have you ever stopped to consider this? There has only been two presidents in the history of the United States who bypassed the international banking system and tried to issue interest-free money. Okay, Lincoln even said that, you know, the one true creative advantage that the government has is that it can print its own money. So to finance the war between the states, he printed greenbacks, his own money, through the Treasury Department, bypassing the international bankers. And Kennedy, in June of 1963, issued $6 billion in currency, not through the Federal Reserve System that we have to pay interest to, but through the Treasury Department, which we don't have to pay interest in. So the only two presidents that tried to issue interest-free money in the history of the United States, and both of them were shot in the head in public. I don't think that was a sheer coincidence.
John Kennedy had talked about dissolving the Federal Reserve, which
is not exactly
what the investment banking community, Wall Street, and the international bankers were looking for. Yeah, but John Kennedy had so many enemies, powerful enemies.
Oh, yeah.
You know, for the big oil, Israel on the nuclear arms issue.
Oh, yeah.
LBJ and
his
buddies.
He was going to close off Vietnam.
Vietnam and the military-industrial complex, the CIA, and to me, what's the reason that JFK was such a turning point, such an important event to still investigate and pursue is that it was an in-your-face, you know, military triangular-style assassination that basically said to all presidents, you better not stray far off the reservation or this is what we got for you. Is that a sound interpretation?
And you have to understand, like you said earlier, you know, who today still has the power to muddy the waters, okay? Johnson and his wife are dead. The military guys are dead. The mafia chieftains, everybody's been implicated in Kennedy assassination is all dead. But behind them is the power of the international bankers, Wall Street, and that power is still very much there and very much in control. Let me quote to you for a German Chancellor, Otto von Bismarck said at the time of the American Civil War, we got the Beatles coming up, so
we got the Beatles.
Tell you what he said.
We better save that for the other side of the break because we're going to have a news break as well as commercial breaks. More from author Jim Mars after the break. Today, you have the pleasure of listening to Morgan Reynolds, your guest host, interview author Jim Mars, and Jim is a great interviewee because he is number one. He's a charming guy. He's a really a nice man, but also opinionated and knowledgeable. So we can range all over the presidential groups we've dealt with in the past and are about to deal with, and this being a presidential year. And before we took the break, in the context, I was saying that, the JFK assassination is so important because it shows that some people call it a rogue element that was never rooted out. It was an inside job, and it basically demonstrated that the powers that be are going to take out one way or another any president who doesn't stay within certain boundaries, certain very important boundaries. And Jim Mars was referring to Otto von Bismarck, the unifier of the German principalities at all, known as the Iron Chancellor. What did Bismarck have to say, Jim?
Well, Bismarck pretty well lined it out, but first let me background us here. You know this, but maybe some of your listeners don't. After the 1776 American Revolution, you know, did Britain just say, oh, well, okay, you broke away, we'll leave you alone? No, they came back and we fought the War of 1812, where they actually sacked Washington and burned the capital and tried to regain North America. But we managed to fight them off once again. And at that point, the France and England, both of whom wanted a share of North America, realized that a united North America, you know, it was so far away and it had so much resources that it was going to be a very difficult to try to regain it. So according to German Chancellor von Bismarck, he said, quote, the division of the United States into federations of equal force was decided long before the Civil War by the high financial powers of Europe. The voice of the Rothschilds prevailed. They sent their emissaries into the field to exploit the question of slavery and to open an abyss between the two sections of the Union. So, wow, what we find out is that the war between the states didn't just happen. It was a conspiracy, a plot, okay? And the whole idea was to get the North and South fighting with each other, bleed each other dry, and then the British were ready to move in from Canada. And where was the French army? It was in Mexico under Maximilian. And the French would move in from the South, and the Europeans would again regain control over North America. So it's amazing. And,
it's well established even by the conventional historians that the Brits were big supporters of the South.
That's right.
That plays into this, and we certainly did, we meaning what was called these United States, bleed ourselves big time, but they weren't able to step in on the carcass, so to speak.
No, and it's interesting why that plan did not prove fruitful. There were two reasons, one of which we know about, one of which most people don't know about. One was Lincoln's decision to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, which he did in late 1863, He had been waiting and waiting until there was a Union victory, and there just hadn't been one. So, after...
And he did it only for the slave states, which he didn't control.
Exactly. Exactly. He didn't free any of the slaves anywhere else. He simply said that the slaves in the states under rebellion were free. Well, he had no control there. So basically, it was a nothing proclamation, except it suddenly, in the middle of the war, raised the issue of slavery to the, a cause célèbre of what the fight was about. And he did that knowing that the populations of France and Britain would hesitate about supporting a slave nation, okay? And sure enough, even though the South had been promised that the British would come in, recognize them, and aid them, they held off. It didn't happen. Now, the second thing that happened was Russia. Tsar Alexander II, who had gotten word that the French and the English, once they had taken care of the problem in North America, were going to turn and try to break up the Russian Empire, he got upset, and he sent his two Russian fleets, and one anchored off San Francisco and one anchored off Virginia, and he let it be known quietly that if Britain was to come in on the side of the South, he was coming in on the side of the North, and these international bankers were suddenly faced with the prospect of World War I 50 years before it actually happened and 50 years before they were ready for it. And so as a result, they did not come in. There was no World War I, and we all know what happened. The North bled the South dry and finally conquered it. So it was all a plot. And it got thwarted, and this is all the machinations that go on that we never get taught about in school. We have this little rose-colored version of history, right?
Yeah, the Disneyfication of American history. That it's like civics classes, right?
Right.
All this superficial institutional structure that doesn't allow you to see what's behind the curtain.
Well, Morgan, what I found out was in school we were taught how city and county and state government works. You know, you've got your house, you've got your senate, you've got the city council, you've got the school board, and they have a head, and they meet, and they make these decisions. But once I got out in the real world and started working as a reporter, I found out that really it doesn't work that way. The decisions are made on the golf course and in the club. In the country clubs, you know. That's where the deals are cut. And when they hold these city council meetings or school board meetings or state legislatures, they just go through the motions because the decisions have already been made.
It's all done in the name of freedom and democracy and such, and yet two better words are money and power.
Let me ask you,
before we leave JFK, you did the book Crossfire, which came out in 1989, and were a consultant on the screenplay and the production of the Oliver Stone's movie JFK, which turned out to be excellent. It's still thrilling. It has tremendous entertainment values, but it also has a great deal of veracity, and it's hard to squeeze in a basic truth of how it went down in 2 hours.
Tell us
a little bit about your experience with Oliver Stone. By contrast, comment on this part too, and that is, he turned out this, I never saw the movie about 9/11, but it was it's pretty much a boring sellout, whereas JFK is a powerful and truth-driven movie.
Right. Well, first off, with the movie JFK, they bought the rights to my book, did bring me in as both a script consultant and a production consultant, and but, you know, I was... Nobody had any strings attached to me, and I was perfectly ready to repudiate the movie if I thought that they had ventured too far from the conclusions I had come to, but I didn't have to do that. And it was really amazing, Morgan, because Oliver Stone didn't just take the information in my book and run with it. He had a very sharp lady named Jane Rusconi who headed up his whole research staff, and they went back and backtracked, and they looked at the same documents I'd looked at. They talked to some of the same people I'd talked to, And they came to the same conclusions I had. Namely,
let's learn a little bit more about the movie JFK from Jen Morris on the other side of the break. The week today, I am your guest host on the Dynamic Duo. My name is Morgan Reynolds, and I'm interviewing author Jim Mars, and we are talking JFK here because it's President's Week. At least unofficially it is. We celebrated President's Day last Monday, and tomorrow is the birthday of George Washington. And before the break, Jim Mars was relaying his experience with Oliver Stone, who made the movie JFK. And Jim Mars' book Crossfire was a basis for the screenplay, and Jim was a consultant on that and on the production, and it turned out extremely well. I'm still amazed at it, Jim, in that here you have a mainstream movie maker who had the courage, and it's remarkable given the kind of mainstream stuff we have today and just the whole shrinkage of investigative journalism of any type or art, and that includes Oliver Stone, who produced a non-entity movie about 9/11 where there's such an opportunity to reveal the truth as it was, so much truth was revealed in the movie JFK. So tell us more.
Yeah, first off, you have to know that he did not just slide through with JFK. There was great resistance. The studios tried to get him not to do that. There was a lot of pressure on him not to do it. And then they were even some question as to who would see to its distribution. But what's interesting is that long before all that happened, I was telling my classes at UTA, I said, you know what, those people behind the assassination, they'll even tell on themselves if they can profit from it, okay? Because after all, under corporatism, you know, it's the bottom line that counts. So I said, yeah, they'll even tell on themselves. So sure enough, what happened was is Stone had such a reputation by that time that Warner Brothers, who released the JFK film, the people that headed that, they knew that if they did not release and distribute JFK, that he'd just go to somebody else, and they would, and they'd lose the money. So they went ahead and sucked it up, and they went ahead and released the movie. Now, of course, that brings us up to Twin Towers, which, you know, I got to admit, who wants to spend 2 hours watching somebody buried under a pile of rubble, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But you have to understand that between those two movies, Stone, who unfortunately appears to have some sort of a drug and alcohol problem, had been arrested more than two or three times for possession of drugs. And under California's three strikes, you out laws, you know, he very well could have been facing a long prison term.
A life in prison.
A life in prison. So it's easy to see where he could have been leveraged into making a movie that would go along with the official version. But even then, you know, there were some interesting points in that movie. For example, when the fireman headed by Nicolas Cage is there trying to come out of the building, if you listen closely, there's not just one big boom. There's boom, 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 boom. There's a series of explosions going on, and things are blowing out from the side and everywhere else. So although he did not get to some of the information that I think you and I would have considered much more critical and more important, I think in a subtle way, he left it open to the idea that those buildings didn't just suddenly fall down because they got hit by airplanes.
You used the word leverage. That's really interesting because I'd like to use the next few minutes to cover some ground quickly before we go contemporary in our presidential election year. But leverage, what about the story regarding Ronald Reagan? Because it's a puzzle. He disliked, and Nancy Reagan certainly disliked, hated George Herbert Walker Bush, and yet Reagan put him on the ticket as vice president. So
right.
one kind of tale is, well, hey, David Rockefeller calls Reagan in. He's got a lot of leverage because Reagan was a Hollywood type. We got a lot
right.
of blackmail stuff. So you put him on, and, you know, that's our powers-to-be guy inside. What happened there?
Well, that's entirely possible, but of course on private telephone conversations, I guess we'll never know. But what we do know from the official record is that in the New Hampshire primaries, Reagan was severely attacking Bush and his participation with the Council on Foreign Relations, that secretive group that has run the State Department since before World War II, and it pledged that he would never allow Bush to have a place in his administration. And yet, we get to the Republican National Convention, and of course, Reagan gets the nomination right off, and the only question was, who is he going to choose as vice president? Well, the week wore on, and obviously there were some behind-the-scenes battles going on. And then all of a sudden, the national news media, which, as you well know, is under the control of about five corporations, they start talking about the dream ticket. Ronald Reagan with Gerald Ford as vice president. But, of course, since Gerald Ford had already been president, he would get to select half the cabinet. So all of a sudden, talk about leverage, Reagan is now faced with half a government. So on Wednesday night, about 11:30, almost midnight, he rushes into the convention and says, listen, I want to put a stop to all these rumors and all of this, conjecture. And he says, I nominate George Bush. And there, and from then went on, and of course he never had anything bad to say about Bush after that, but of course less than 2 months after he took office, he got shot, and Bush was in office. And by the way, that's something else people need to know. We know about the Iran-Contra scandal, which Bill Moyers called a coup d'etat, and an attempt to start a war in Central America specifically against legislation passed by Congress. And we know about Colonel Oliver North, who admitted that he lied to Congress on behalf of the National Security Council. But they all said, yeah, but we had the approval of the president. Well, nobody's bothered to ask which president, because as it turns out, all of the documents that were signed that really got us into this Iran-Contra thing were signed by George Bush, not Ronald Reagan.
Yeah,
it was done while Reagan was hospitalized and recuperating from the assassination attempt.
Yeah, I think Webster Carpley would go further and basically say that George Herbert Walker Bush, aided, of course, by James Baker especially, served three terms as president, in effect. Is that too much, going too far, do you think, Jim Mars?
Yeah.
Is that going too far to say that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Reagan, recuperated for a long time, and then certainly understood where the power.
Today, I'm Morgan Reynolds. I'm serving as a guest host in Jim's stead, and I'm talking with author Jim Mars during this presidential week, and we've covered a lot of historical ground here, but. Now I'd like to turn to contemporary presidential politics in this election year of 2008. And it looked for a while going into these primaries that we were supposed to have a continuation of the Bush-Clinton duo or families, political families, and certainly Jim Mars and Morgan Reynolds want to change the world, but more like a restoration, I suppose, of a constitutional commercial republic, a decentralized system once called these United States, that's plural. But there seems to be little prospect of that in this presidential year.
That's true.
But what about, let's, before we focus on, we've got two Democrats still running in the form of Hillary Rodham Clinton and Barack Hussein Obama. I want to put that aside for a moment. And then let's talk about a couple of Republicans that were knocked out of the running here. We had Rudy Giuliani. He was a 9/11 candidate. Actually, John McCain is not to quite the same extent, but McCain is something of a 9/11 candidate. For example, he wrote the foreword to the Popular Mechanics humbug book on 9/11. But we had Rudy Giuliani, and then Mitt Romney. Now, the voters, these two guys, Giuliani and Romney, seem like front men for the real money and power, don't they? And the voters knock them out.
Yes. In fact, what I found most interesting was in New York, in the New York primaries, Ron Paul got more votes than Rudy Giuliani did, which shows you those people in New York know what kind of politician he is. And let me point out, too, that Rudy Giuliani, you know, I'm sure you're aware of the Trans-Texas Corridor that they're trying to push through, which is just the Texas leg of the NAFTA-inspired Canamex Superhighway that's going to stretch from southern Mexico up into Canada. And but in Texas, that leg of it is called the Trans-Texas Corridor, and it's going to be a toll road. So, and yet the money is going to go to Spain because a Spanish company called Centra is in working in conjunction with Zachary Construction out of San Antonio, and they are going to have the sole rights to build and to maintain the concessions, the gas stations and the hotels and restaurants along this super corridor. And according to the Texas Department of Transportation, the sole legal representative of Centra, the Spanish company, is a Houston law firm, Bracewell and Giuliani. Yes, Rudy Giuliani was going to represent the Spanish company that wants to split the United States in half with their super highway, which is a thinly disguised effort by the New World Order people to be able to bring their cheap Chinese goods into southern Mexico, where there's no OSHA and there's no labor unions and there's nobody to, you know, keep their lead impregnated products out, and they put them on Mexican trucks, and then they run them up into the United States with the only customs checkpoint to be located at the Smart Port in Kansas City, Missouri, which will be staffed by Mexicans, and they are demanding that it be declared sovereign Mexican territory.
Wow.
I mean, this is what we have going there, so it's a good thing they got rid of Giuliani. But now let's look at who's behind all the candidates that's still left on the plate. And from what I can tell, we actually, in this election of 2008, we only have two choices. You can vote for Obama, who is, his chief advisor is Zygmunt Brzezinski, okay, the head of the trilateral
commission. I was naive enough. Obama has this charismatic,
he's very charismatic.
Like a cult, Newsweek and some other observers are saying.
Right.
And at least he denounced the war in Iraq in pretty solid terms. But then when I saw Brzezinski, and the more I learn, the less there is to like.
Right. So Brzezinski is behind, and the Trilateral Commission, the New World Order, is behind Obama. Behind Hillary Clinton, of course, is the Bush-Clinton cabal and the Bilderbergs. She was the only American first lady to have attended Bilderberg meetings, and she didn't just attend. She was at the front door greeting people as they came in, which is a time-honored method of introducing their protégés to their membership. So you got the Bilderbergers, the New World Order, the North American Union behind Hillary. Then you got McCain, and who's his chief advisor? Behind McCain, we find the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission. And then even behind Mike Huckabee, we find one of his chief supporters is Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yeah, he's a Rockefeller guy.
Exactly.
The Rockefellers have been big, and the Stevens in the state I currently reside in, which is Arkansas. Yeah, he has a good nickname, Huckster, Mike Huckster. He is a vicious piece of work. I can vouch for that.
Oh, yeah.
He cannot take any criticism. I mean, he's a full-time attack.
Oh, and
he's about a theological degree, man of the cloth. What
right.
A racket tearing that is.
Well, they all are. And behind John McCain, his chief advisor is Henry Kissinger, for God's sakes. So, I mean, you know, so Morgan, what it boils down to is actually we have two choices in this election. You can vote for the New World Order and the North American Union, or you can vote for Ron Paul. That's it, baby.
That's right. Yeah, all four of the, we'll call Huckabee yet a major candidate, are well approved. They're all within the control of the PTB. And then you have Dr. Ron Paul, who, of course, they turned the lights off on him.
Right. He's
once
a non-person.
It looked like, Hmm?
In Russia, they used to call him a non-person. He's a non-person.
Non-person, doctor, no. You know, wouldn't, just imagine, let's go on a flight of fancy. Wouldn't this be quite amazing to have him, maybe he'd last a couple of months if he were elected president. He's in the White House.
Yeah, he'd be like Reagan. He'd survive maybe 2 months after he was inaugurated.
Right. Yeah, before they'd have to kill him. But imagine him with the Democrats, of course, are going to probably deepen their margin up on Capitol Hill. So all these vending bills come back up there.
There you go.
One veto after the other, right?
Well, what would be interesting is that if they get to the Republican National Convention, and it looks right now like McCain's going to, sweep the convention, but maybe not, because all this stuff's starting to come out about McCain. All you have to do is look at him closely, and you realize that, he's going to be another Bush, if not worse. He is a hawk to the right of Dick Cheney. McCain's the one who said he'll stay in Iraq for 100 years. And then now we have this scandal coming up about him sleeping with a lobbyist. And I mean, that's probably just the tip of the iceberg. That's just something they think will titillate the public. He's got lots of other dirty stuff. And of course, he's playing on his background as a POW in Vietnam. But if you go look at the website, Vietnam Veterans Against McCain, you'll find that they don't even have any regard for him.
Yeah, it's kind of a sad situation in many ways, but we'll talk more about our presidential politics on the other side of the break. Today, Morgan Reynolds, that's me. I'm serving as your guest host instead of Jim Fetzer, and I'm interviewing Jim Mars, author. So we're getting the view from Mars. You want to go buy one of his books. He's got at least a half a dozen excellent books out there, including Crossfire, the JFK book that we touched on earlier. And now we've moved on in this presidential week to contemporary presidential politics. And in this last segment, this comes under the umbrella, what can be done? What can people like us, people of our views, who see the rot that's so visible, and doesn't look like Ron Paul is going to be able to get the Republican nomination, but...
Morgan, there is a possibility. Right now it looks like McCain's a shoe-in, but between now and the convention, it could be that enough dirt comes out on him that a lot of people begin to have second thoughts. And if for some reason he does not get the first ballot on the Republican National Convention, that then it turns it into a brokered convention, which means that the delegates then are freed from their obligation to vote
after the first ballot.
The first ballot, which means they're free to vote their conscience, which means if enough Ron Paul supporters got in there, then... they could maybe push his name forward. It's not over yet.
That would be quite a Donnybrook, quite an entertainment alone to watch.
Yeah, wouldn't it? That'd be a real dog and pony show.
But, now McCain, if he does get the nomination and is the Republican candidate, I predict he will get whomped by either Democrat, just whomped, partly because the American people are fed up with war, and he's nothing but a warmonger.
And if that doesn't work, and that may be the scenario, which is to then put in this, somebody that's to the right of Attila the Hun, and so that everybody then would turn and vote for a Obama-Clinton or Clinton-Obama ticket. But if it looks like it's going to be close, then you hide and watch. What they'll do is they'll run up some third-party candidate. Now, Ron Paul has said he would not accept and would not run as a third-party candidate. He might be talked into that by saying, simply appealing to his honesty and say, look at all these people out here who support you. Look at your constituency. You owe them something. But if he sticks to his guns, they'll run somebody else up there, and they'll run a third-party candidate who will suck votes from the moderates and progressives away from McCain, which then will certainly ensure that a Obama-Clinton-Clinton-Obama ticket gets it, and that's the game plan.
So, third party wouldn't necessarily achieve the aims of the supporters of a third party effort in town.
No.
Okay.
It's the same thing that happened here in Texas in 2006. If you go back and look at the numbers, you'll find that 65% of the voters in Texas voted against Rick Perry, who is, of course, the main force pushing this Trans-Texas Corridor, this NAFTA Super Canamex Highway.
The first Aggie governor of Texas, I'm sorry to say.
Right, okay. 65% of the voters voted against him, and yet he got in anyway because they had split the ticket up between Grandma Strayhorn, who was the mother of Scott McClellan, Bush's White House press secretary, an obvious spoiler and probably knew it, and then Kinky Friedman, who, from what I know, is a perfectly great guy, but I'd like to know who put him up to that and gave him money to run, because he's another spoiler. And then you have the Libertarian candidate, the Democratic candidate, and it split the vote up so much that Rick Perry got in again, even though 65% of the voters did not want him.
I didn't know that. That's remarkable. Well,
but that's Morgan, that is standard operating procedure of these New World Order people. This goes all the way back to the election of 1912, where Howard Taft had already said he would veto any banking bill because he knew it was nothing but a boon for the bankers. And so the bankers then went to Teddy Roosevelt and talked him into running on the Bull Moose Party, and it split votes away from Taft, and Woodrow Wilson, their fair-haired boy,
Teddy Roosevelt was always an agent of the J.P. Morgan forces.
Sure. And so by splitting the ticket, they got Wilson in, and he immediately puts in the Federal Reserve System.
Yeah.
And the income tax.
1913, that was an awful year for those two things. Plus, they got rid of state legislatures appointing U.S. senators. They were, U.S. senators were delegates from the state, so they cut away at the state sovereignty again. But
right.
Two more subjects I want to bring up, get your input on. First one is that 9/11 hasn't broken out really into the mainstream yet. It's still bottled up.
Morgan, the national polls show that well over half the people in this country understand that there's something wrong with the official story. And in fact, in some polls, it's gone up as high as 65% or so who are willing to believe that it was an inside job and that government officials had something to do with it. That's an incredible turnaround in just 7 years. And yet, like you said, because of the control over the media, most people don't get to hear about this, or if they hear something, it's like conspiracy theory. And yet, every day, there's something coming out that solidifies this. For example, I know you know this, the FBI officially, a spokesman, has said that they're not listing Osama bin Laden as wanted for 9/11 because they have no hard evidence that he was involved, which is true.
Right.
Which is true.
Right.
Now the FBI has said that they have no evidence that that phone call was ever made by Barbara Olson to Ted Olson.
Right.
Which started off as just one little story on CNN and then blossomed into the whole foundation for believing that these hijackers had captured those planes and did all their dastardly deeds.
It is a daily drip, or this book by this New York Times reporter,
right,
Philip Shannon, who points out or documents these constant calls between the 9/11 Commission director, Philip Zelikow, and Karl Rove and the White House generally. So they kept that thing entirely controlled. That is
That's
the
true.
So-called 9/11 investigation.
And they're both in 9/11, and you can also go back to the Kennedy assassination. All you have to do is ask yourself, something that momentous, the greatest terrorist attack in American history, the murder of a sitting U.S. president, and they can't seem to get to the bottom of it? I mean, how ridiculous is that? I mean, they solve crimes all the time. And, if you and I robbed 7-Eleven, they'd be after us in a minute.
But
the federal government can't seem to figure out what happened there. That should be a tip-off to any thinking person that something's amiss.
And they can't, they've got their arch villain, their OBL, Osama bin Laden. They can't find him. They can't capture him.
Lee Harvey Oakley. Lee Harvey Osama.
Well, here's the last issue.
Hey, you don't pay your you just don't file your income tax form this year and see how quick they find you.
Right. Yeah.
They can't find Osama.
Well, that gets at this whole point about once the Soviet Union collapsed, they have no big bogeyman. Defense spending and the military-industrial complex was slowly dying on the vine. In fact, spending on defense was lower at the end of the 90s than it was at the beginning.
Right.
So what did they do? They ginned up this big enemy, which is called the 1 billion Muslims and Islamist fascist terrorists, on and on. You know, it's just, you wonder why more people can't see through this, if only for that fraud. You know,
well,
they
can't see through it because they're caught in a matrix, an electromagnetic matrix woven by the mass media that is totally under control.
Yeah, when is America going to wise up and throw off the belief in the government and then its propaganda ministry, these five national news corporations? Well, that answer will come in a subsequent show, won't it, Jim? Right now, we thank everyone for listening to the Dynamic Duo and today's guest, Jim Mars. Go to his site, buy his book, jimmars.com.